Authors Over 50, Writing in Life's Sweetest Third. Authors Over 50's weekly podcast celebrates writers and their journeys to publication. Writing after 50 is a whole story on its own, so let's skip to Life's Sweetest Third and talk with authors about their journey from pen to publish. Welcome, I'm Julia Daly, your host, and I invite you to listen to interviews with writers who've achieved their goal of publishing a book just later in life. We've seen award lists for under 30 or under 40, but I've yet to see lists for those who've achieved a significant milestone of their own, launching a new career and publishing their first book after the age of 50. We will hear about these authors' inspirations, struggles, strategies, and the smell of that first book. These writers' journeys inspire me because I'm one of them. My guest today is an award-winning author who served as a public school teacher for 30 years before turning to historical investigation and writing. In 2008, the Texas State Legislature honored her career in education by formal resolution. A Western Writers of America Spur Award winner twice, she also won the Caroline Bancroft History Prize from the Western History and Genealogy Department of the Denver Public Library, the Best Historical Nonfiction Award from the Texas Association of Authors, and was a finalist for the Oklahoma Book Award. She lives in the White Mountain Wilderness in New Mexico with her husband, Gary, and dog, Axel. Welcome to Authors Over 50, Jane Little Botkin.
Thank you.
Jane, our opening question on Authors Over 50 is always, what took you so long to write your first book?
You know, I didn't think I could write. I was a senior English teacher and a freshman English teacher for 30 years. And I thought my students wrote far better than I did. But when I had them, we started researching the history of Hays County in Texas, and we started putting out a yearly book on that history, and I had my students do the researching. They were pre-AP GT class, and I would read their work, and I go, gosh, they're so good with the way they put words together, but I always loved the history part of it and the research. And so I would take them deep into the, you know, basements of, well, at that time, Hays County Courthouse, it was like in a dead zone, to do the research and get the letters and interview the elderly people to get those stories. So I would go in to take the students into these areas to get this research and then show them how to document it and how to write the questions. This is what I loved. So fast forward to 2002, and of course, teacher, I taught my own sons, which they can't say necessarily was great, but we were a small school district at that time in Dripping Springs, Texas. And my son came into my office one day and he said, Mom, he was showing me a cartoon and he said, isn't this our uncle? He was in an advanced placement American history class and he had to write a DBQ, which was a document-based question for his class. And it showed a man being hanged with the Montana Vigilante Code 3777 pinned to his body. And also two men, one wearing a mask representing the robber barons that we studied, you know, when we were in high school from the turn of the 1900s. And he's wearing a mask and he's hovering over the newspaper journalist and he's dropping like 30 pieces of silver into his hand and saying, okay, just tell them he's a traitor. And I looked at that and I said, yes, that's my uncle. And he goes, that's what I thought. And so I thought, gosh, I need to tell the story. And I knew that my parents, because my uncle was a radical, I mean, truly was a radical labor organizer who literally his death shut down the country at a time when we were going into World War I. My family had not talked about him. They'd hidden it. And I thought it was because he was a socialist, which he was. Of course, all of Oklahoma was pretty much socialist in 1907 because of events that happened there. I thought, well, I need to research this. So I waited a few years, and that was in 2002. And 2008 came, and I'd been talking about it. When I retire, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to write a book. But it was the research. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to research it. I hadn't really thought about writing it, you know, once I got the research. So I, sure enough, I retired. And so in 2008, when I was 56, I retired and I started my journey researching. And because my uncle, who's named Frank Little, and I'll hold up the book so you can see it with the Spur Award stickers on it, because he had gone into 10 different states to organize miners, he started out, then it was farm workers before there ever was a Cesar Chavez. He was the first pioneer of the Western free speech fights. He's very, very famous for what all he did, went everywhere. I had to go and walk the walk and go into these small archives and go find people. And it took me another, well, it took me from 2008 until 7 years to do the research is basically what it did. Then it took me one more year to write it. And so there I was, and I needed to publish a book. And I thought, okay, now what do I do? I didn't know anything. I didn't know anybody who wrote books. And so I'd always told my seniors when they were applying for college, okay, guys, this is what you do. You need to decide that one university and college is really kind of out of your reach, but that's your dream one. And you apply there. You apply for the very easiest. Well, you know, you can go to ACC, and I don't mean to cut Austin Community College, but that was a given. You could go to ACC or and then pick one right in the middle that's probably pretty safe. And a lot of them would say, okay, Texas State at that time. And so, and I'm not trying to step on any toes, but I'm a Texas Tech fan, so I'll just say that right now. Anyway, so I thought, well, I need to apply that also to myself. So I looked at all the different university presses, and the University of Oklahoma Press, which had the most outstanding reputation for Western literature, that was my high one. And when I went to the website, again, it's very formidable. You look, well, there's all these different acquisition editors, and they represent like women, military history, you know, it goes on, labor history. Well, in my book, Frank Little and the IWW, The Blood That Stained an American Family, it hit all of those areas. So I thought, okay, I'll email the editor in chief and ask him which acquisitions editor. This was a blessing. It turned out the editor-in-chief, Charles Rankin, who was the most wonderful editor I think they've ever had, had worked as the editor of the Montana Historical Quarterly for 12 years. And my uncle had been hanged. He'd been lynched in Butte, Montana. And he knew the story. And he knew that there no one had told the everything. All they knew was he was lynched. It was the largest funeral ever in Butte, Montana, bigger than Evel Knievel's, who's buried not far from him. And that he had changed, in effect, had changed things in America. And he said, I want it. Send it to me. And that was it. And so from just meeting him, that connection, then he has been my editor, even on this last manuscript I've done. He has worked with me. He's long since retired from OU Press. But that's how I got in. My first writing was horrible, I think. I mean, what you do, before they decide if they're going to publish it, they send it out to some professionals to read it. And I remember this one old professor came back and he goes, said something about purple prose. It just broke my heart, but I learned. And I also learned that how to be more concise. I had to cut 50,000 words out of my book. So it, you know, and cutting, you learn very quickly how to edit. A lot later, I had a guy offer to buy the 50,000 words from me because he wanted to know the rest of it that I had cut out. But that was my first venture. I was 65 when this book came out. So I started at 56. It took me a while, and I was 65 when it came out. And I would say that process is extremely important. It doesn't matter how long it takes. Now, I'm a nonfiction writer, so I can say that. I watch people, I have friends who turn out a book or two books even a year, and I'm like, wow, I don't know how you do that. But I had to learn first from teaching. My husband said, why didn't you start sooner? Well, I had to teach. And I learned, like I said, I learned from my students who took risks with their writing. And I'm not generally that kind of risk taker. I am a risk taker in other areas, but if I think it's something that someone's going to judge me, I'm a little bit, I hold back. But you take risks. And so, yeah, it's been so much fun. It's been like starting a whole new life.
Well, Janie, you wrote a couple of these books on very serious topics, and I'm always so intrigued. I mean, you have such a legacy in your own family with this uncle and the history here, and that's such a fascinating path to follow. And I always think, how did one person in a family or one person in the nation, you know, have the impetus to do something like this when the rest, you know, we're sitting back and watching things happen, but didn't feel compelled to make a difference. You know, that's always so fascinating. And you had it in your own family.
Yeah. And I dedicated the book to the Silent Generation, which was my grandpa and his brothers and sisters, because I found out the reason that my father didn't know as much. He just said, oh, that's the socialist who was hanging from a telegraph pole. He even had that wrong. It was they kept it secret because at that time, the Bureau of Investigation, which is today's FBI, raided my great-grandfather's home, who was Frank's oldest brother. I mean, we had all these raids. It's almost a repeat of some things today that happened then, in that the Bureau of Investigation was spying on people. They were opening your mail. Because of Frank, the Sedition Act was passed. And, you know, we already had the Espionage Act because of World War I. Well, they didn't want any of the workers to rise up because they needed them to mine that copper and lead, you know, for bullets and do the wheat for the, you know, because the Russians had blocked the wheat. There was a wheat embargo. And so they needed all of these sources. And so the workers were trying to work. But as I explained to groups when I talked to them, and again, my senior English students will tell you that I was really a history teacher, not an English teacher, because I always would go into the background on the literature. But the Finnish people and the Swedes didn't want to fight with the Russians. They were their enemies. So they didn't want to be involved in World War I. And the Irish, who were here working as immigrants in the United States, they didn't want to be with the English. The same reason. So you had that saying where it was a rich man's war, but a poor man's fight. That was what was going on. And Frank, pretty much just from free speech fights, just from talking on soapboxing on corners, he and the industrial workers of the world, the IWW, became enemies of the American government, and they wanted them shut down because they could control industry. And that was the bottom line. But the punitive actions spread across the United States, and people were put in jail just for speaking German. They might have been here for like in Fredericksburg. I think Janice Woods Wendell wrote the book Will's War. And if you read that, it's her, you know, about a family member. They were German, and he was, the community turned on him because he was German, and he had to go to court. And this was a real time. And so, it was fascinating that Frank had made such a difference. So I enjoyed that, and I enjoyed talking about him.
Well, that was a huge project and a huge research project. What about your second book?
It's really funny. Still the same side of the family. My dad's mother, we knew nothing about. And the more we found out that actually her mother, my great grandmother, might have been maybe a prostitute who came west. She was a Danish immigrant, and there was no father. And my grandmother was born in Denver. And when my great grandmother died, she was whisked away to Iowa, supposedly with relatives. She was 15 years old, and they married her off to a 30-something-year-old man, farmer, Norwegian farmer. She lasted there 1 year, and then she came back to Denver. And so again, there's all that mystery in the family. Frank, I found out, had helped supposedly a housemaid, organize a housemaid's union in Denver. Her name was Jane Street, and she had started this housemaid's union because she was wanting to punish the elite ladies on Denver's Capitol Hill who had besmirched. They had said very derogatory things about immigrant women who were murdered in the Ludlow Massacre in 1914 in Colorado. It's horrific. They just thought that they were like animals. Well, I found out that my grandmother had, when she escaped, she had gone to Boulder the exact same year and was hiding in a mansion in Boulder where she was working as a domestic. because for Scandinavian girls, if you're not married, good girls become maids, become domestics. That's considered honorable. And I thought, wow, that is just so close to home. Well, I thought I'll look into that one too, because I always love the family connections. And sure enough, Jane Street wasn't a maid. She was actually a skilled stenographer, had a horrible life with men herself. I mean, it's a great story.
Janie, you have a family that is so rich to mine. Not many writers have such a family to mine, and you are just so fortunate to have all those strong personalities and strong history of these people in your family.
I just don't have enough years to live, I don't think, to tell all the stories I want to.
Well, now you're writing about something as a Mississippian I didn't know anything about, and it's called Guy Rex.
It's called the Pink Dress. Memoir of a Guy Rex girl. Yeah.
Okay. But Guy Rex were the famous Miss USA and Miss Texas beauty queen makers. So I'm wondering, is that a lighter subject than the other two books you've written?
No, it is and it isn't. I was at a Women's Writing the West Conference in San Antonio in 2019. It was right before COVID started. And we were sitting in the bar late at night, and it was just some ladies I just met, which is the best way if you're writing with women. And there was a literary agent in there, and we were in there telling stories. And I started telling stories about this pageant. And I had them laughing. And the agent said, you need to tell Guy Rex's story. And I said, no, I don't want to write about Richard Guy and Rex Holt. She goes, no, you really need to write this. So I went to bed that night and I thought about it. And then I thought, well, yeah, I could tell it. But then I realized it was a deeper story, because it is also the relationship between a mother and a daughter. My parents literally gave me to Guy Rex, which was bizarre. My father at that time period, it's like normally he would have been, no, I don't think we're going to do that. But they were having marriage difficulties. And these two guys were so outstanding already in El Paso. They called him the boys because they could just, they were very, very talented. But they did. They handed me over to them. Basically, I was an 18-year-old and they took charge of me. I was really young. But I wrote the story about becoming the first Guy Rex girl, and Guy Rex girl is a trademark. They were known for sculpting the girls into these winners. They won 5 Miss USAs. They became called the Texas Aces. That's your 4 suits plus a wild card. They were literally asked to leave the Miss USA pageant because the other states said, that's impossible. How can you win 5? Well, they could. And there was a scandal with the Miss America, Miss Texas pageant. I was the first one that was involved with that in the beginning of that. It's a great, great story. It is a memoir. And I've had one New York editor tell me he thought it was more of a regional book. But it's really not, because it does go all the way to Atlantic City and it goes to New York. As far as the impact of these two men had, they were just extremely talented. But I fought them. Oh, did I fight them? I had not ever had anybody control me. My mother was controlling, but this was something else. So, yeah, it's that year. And then it is about my relationship with my mother through all of this infidelity with my father. It ends in 2016, I think, or so, with my granddaughter trying to try on a dress, the pink dress, on a dress form. And I can't even zip it up on the dress form because they made my gowns 19 and a half inches. I had to lose weight until I had a 21 inch waist. And then my dresses were sewn 19 and a half and they would literally squeeze me in and I couldn't eat. And so it covers 2 Miss Texas pageants, 1 in San Antonio, the 1 in Fort Worth, 1 for Miss USA Universe, 1 for Miss America. A lot of prominent people and some infamous people that have been written quite about, books have been about, who were involved with me. And then, of course, getting all the way to the end and realizing that the sum of your measurements does not define you. I'm telling my granddaughter that, who wants to wear the crown and put on the dress.
I just love how it goes to the next generation and your advice to your own granddaughter after what you experience. I just find that so fascinating. So I can't wait to read it.
Well, it will be out. As I said, it's called, I don't think they're going to change the title. It's called The Pink Dress, Memoir of a Gyrex Girl. And it is supposed to be out, earliest will be August of 2004. So it is a wait. In May, we'll start putting the book together. So I'm working on all the permissions and things like that for photographs and music.
Is this the same publisher?
No, I could have taken it to a university press, University of Oklahoma Press, but I thought I wanted to do a traditional. So I thought, okay, I'll just go to the Women Writing the West Conference, which was in Oklahoma City this year. And I signed up. There was only one editor there who would even take memoirs, but She Writes Press was there. And I knew it was a hybrid and they do like memoirs. But it's a whole different ballgame because you've got to, it's not self-publishing, but you've got a stake in it also and in the company. And so if you did get accepted, and so I had to go through the process. It took 3 months of them to evaluate and assess. And then it had to go to another committee. And then they notified me at Christmas. Yes, we want the book. So I just recently signed the contract. We'll see how this goes. I'm excited. I know they're going to put out the books. If the marketing is going to be no different than if I were at a university press. University presses do very little because they're on a limited budget. So in this case, I'll be marketing a lot myself. They'll get the books out. That's no problem into bookstores anywhere else. But it's no different than what I've done. I think Jane Street, I was in Colorado. Oh, my goodness. I bet 15 times last year. And so I'm ready to hit Texas when this happens. And I can't wait.
Well, She Writes Press is very well respected in the industry, and they are famous for their memoirs. So I'm sure you're going to do quite well there. Have you started any marketing, or with your first two books, did you find anything that worked or maybe that didn't work? Even the big five publishers require their writers now to do most of their marketing.
Well, a podcast just like this is wonderful. I've done a number of podcasts. And of course, I think the trick is whether you do a podcast or you are featured in a magazine, and I have had a couple of those because of the awards. Those help, but you have to get that out yourself, whether it's on Twitter or Facebook. And then if you get it to your publishing company, then they send it as well. I have been very remiss with newsletters. This is something I'm going to be working on and having a mailing list. This is new for me. I'm going to be doing that. And for the first time ever, I'm going to be approaching indie bookstores in Texas. The University of Oklahoma Press, they won't put your books in bookstores. And I found out why after working with She Writes Press is because the returns policy, when you get your books returned, that costs money. And they will order a bunch of books, let them sit there, and they say, okay, we don't want these sitting here now. We're going to send them back. And so I'm learning more of the aspects of how this works behind the scenes that I was never told at OU Press. So I'm kind of trying to get a little bit more savvy to the game on this, but I already have some independent bookstores who want to see The Pink Dress, and I have friends who live all over the state. I'm going to try to, that I can stay with to save money instead of a hotel. And I'm going to try to go to as many book festivals as I can. I have found out that also makes a difference. So between book festivals, I always tell people, yes, it's worth it to enter awards. Make sure it is, they are reputable organizations that give the awards, not ones who just want money and have like 100 different prize categories. Because if you are selected for a winner and it's a reputable award, that goes a long way too. So I'm going to try with this book as well, as it was very fortunate for me. The Spur Award winning really opened doors for me from Western Writers of America. So I'm very excited about that.
Well, Janie, I started with my first book. It was had a thread of memoir running through it because I'm an adopted child from a maternity home in New Orleans. And so I started my own personal tour in New Orleans at that maternity home. So maybe you need to revisit El Paso and start your tour there. And you will probably get a lot of press because certainly that name is still very important there.
Yeah, I'm speaking to a book club, a women's book club in El Paso in May, and it's about Jane Street. But I've been told really all they want to hear about is the pink dress. I think they're looking to see if their family name might be in there or something like that. I don't know.
I bet that's the truth. Well, tell us a little bit more about the passages you've brought to share today, and then read from your book
okay.
so that we can hear your tone and voice.
All right. I am actually going to read. I debated. There is a passage where my roommates, there were four of us, and I sneaked down at TCU to the lobby for the Miss Texas, Miss America pageant. And I've been starving, and Guy and Rex have been watching me, and they brought in this big Texas size sheet cake. This one girl who wanted to win Miss Congeniality. I mean, it was the size of a card table, and I was starving. We walked down at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I thought, I'll read that passage about how I ate all of West Texas, the panhandle, because I was born there and so forth. But no, I'm going to start this off mainly because I want to see the relationship with my mom and where it was going. And this is the opening chapter, but part of it, just part of it. Wanted, you could be Miss America. The words proclaimed in black and white above and below the beaming face of Phyllis George, Miss America, 1971. Phyllis was America's girl next door, wholesome and tan, her dark glossy lips and a dimpled smile revealing perfect white teeth. Even better, she was a Texan, and we Texans believe that our state produced more beauty queens than any other state. Maddie, one of my Tri-Delta sorority sisters, had snatched the poster from the UTEP, University of Texas at El Paso, campus student union, and now held it up in the air in the tiled foyer of our sorority house. Her black eyes sparkled with excitement as she spoke rapidly among a circle of girls who had arrived between classes to eat and chat. The main floor of the house was an open design, and the girls standing at the kitchen's island had to pause their lunch making to hear what caused the excited babble of voices. In a corner of our main meeting room, to the right of the wide foyer, plumes of white smoke softly swirling above the daily spades game also seemed to linger. Players paced their fanned cards upside down and tapped long Virginia slams into ashtrays, already brimming over while they, too, listened. They didn't dare rise. Doing so would require putting their cigarettes down, and a Tri-Delta never walked with a cigarette in hand. Someone turned down the radio on the sound system in the polished con-paneled wall, and Crosby, Steele, Nash & Young's voices faded with Tin Soldiers and Nixon's Coming. A lyrical reminder about American discontent on college campuses giving way to Maddie's voice. Like other university campuses across the country in 1971, our campus, sitting at the foot of Franklin Mountain, directly next to an international border, had been a microcosm of American political disruption. Walter Cronkite's Evening News with his nightly body counts and Life magazine's weekly graphic images fragmented our daily lives, adding color to stories about Vietnam protests and massacres, weathermen bombings and Black Power and La Raza Unida rallies, sit-ins, bomb scares, and streakers wearing nothing but their ski masks peppered my collegiate career as I tried to find my place among scholarly and social organizations while radical groups fomented on campus. I'd not been a rebel, at least not yet, but rather an extraordinarily obedient daughter who feared veering out of her mother's orbit. To make certain that I grew in a healthy environment, my mother became my Girl Scout troop leader, school parent volunteer, cheerleader parent, and primary punisher of all my sins. And because I was understood that college was in my future, mother pressured me to join myriad organizations in preparation. Later, she complained that I burned the candle at both ends, but I didn't care since I'd been so interested in life and learning. To keep up with my activities, mother had to join them in some fashion as well. Why? To ensure my accomplishments. At first, I didn't question my supermom's role in my life, though rebellion had begun fermenting in my mind. I bravely took a wee step in defiance early on, changing the spelling of my name from Janie, J-A-N-E-Y, to Janie, J-A-N-I-E. Yes, I was gutlessly obedient. Still, my secret pleasure every time my mother had to read something with my newly spelled name was something. The sorority was mother's idea. She had been an AD Pi in a Texas panhandle college in a Greek system devoid of men during World War II, and as a result, often reminisced her friendships with other girls who waited patiently for returning soldiers to repopulate their college and their campus. In college, I would meet a suitable husband, she claimed, someone with purpose and a brain. Still, with the university life she engineered for me, she now had to shoulder new worries about the company I kept. This is my favorite part right here. Possibly my mother dreaded that I would sneak out a window to meet a boyfriend, spending all night, something she admitted doing herself. Or possibly she worried that I would run amok, possibly to Juarez, Mexico. There I might sit with my friends in a circle around an ancient table with scarred chairs, their cracked upholsteries prickling my back. Just inside a door near the curve of the Kentucky Club's polished bar. We might play buzz and drink shots, our brains becoming fuzzy each time their tongues thick like cotton fail to buzz a multiple of 7 or 11 or any number with 7 in it. Mother probably feared my walking down Avenida Juarez past dark interest bars and strip clubs, their neon lights flashing and loud music pumping from speakers with hawkers inviting us inside. Hey, girly, venga, venga, adentro, come inside. She might have worried that I would stop under the sign at Fred's Bar to eat a ham and avocado of unknown origin in a sandwich wrapped in a Mexican bolillo and purchased from a ragged street vendor. Inside the doorway, college students and Fort Bliss soldiers would leer and laugh too loudly while we moved on, stepping over litter that stank of decay and debauchery. Perhaps mother feared that 2 pennies might elude my clumsy fingers in the bottom of my bag as I frantically tried to find coins to buy my way home through the turnstile gate at the Santa Fe Bridge, even as the person behind me, dodging a splatter of vomit, would ask, "Anyone got change?" I decided my mother was afraid of me becoming her. There would be no more risk with my education. Instead of attending Rice, where academic funding awaited me, I'd remained in El Paso, bribed to stay home with a used canary yellow GT Mustang convertible. I was not ready to live away from home, mother said. Not ready was her excuse for most everything progressive and out of her control in my life. And I controlled that car 1 year later. I stood on a luxurious cornflower blue carpet in the sorority house's sunken living room to the left of Maddie and the foyer as she read aloud, mentally checking off qualifications. I love this room because of the carpet. My family had squeezed into a post-World War II tract house in northeast El Paso. I couldn't even tell you the carpet color in our living room. Perhaps a grayish beaten down tan like some of the city's residents. $4,000 in scholarships and prizes to be given locally. Must be single, never married, or had a marriage annulled. Check. High school graduate by Labor Day. Check. 18 years old by Labor Day to 28. Check. Have a talent routine. That stopped me. So that's some of the beginning.
Janie, that is just, that threw me right back into college in the 70s and my own mother too. So I think we're kindred spirits there.
And you know, because I am a historian, I can't help it. I do get the history in there. I kind of write it differently. Yeah. I read once someplace that memoirs should be, you know, the bulk of it should be dialogue, but mine isn't, you know, but it worked. So
it's going to be a great book.
Thank you.
Well, as always, our last interview question is, our writers over 50 are a unique set. Do you have any advice for writers 50 and above?
Yes. Do what your heart tells you. If people stop and tell you that you're too old, I would look at them and say, I don't think your lifespan is going to be very long. I truly think that if you have the health and you've got the means to do the writing, even if it means taking risks and you're uncertain, you need to go for it. I know it's keeping me young. And even I was very blessed to get a publisher to begin with. And I think that anybody today, if they really seek out somebody to publish, they can find it. Some people can self-publish. Yeah. But there is nothing stopping anybody today, unless it's your health.
Yeah. I agree. I am interviewing people in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, and they're still writing beautiful work. So I think we can do it as long as people swim, you know, which is the rest of
exactly.
Our lives. So I just appreciate you being with us here today. And we are now excited to say you're one of our authors over 50.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us today. Please look for Authors Over 50 every Thursday when we will have conversations with accomplished debut novelists over the age of 50. Please subscribe and share with a friend. And check out my own publication journey after 50 at www.juliadaily, that's D-A-I-L-Y, like daily newspaper.com. Until next time, keep reading and writing. And remember, it's never too late to fulfill a dream in life's sweetest third.